Sorry, I waited for, okay. We'll call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is the 10th of June. We are in a very dynamic time of session right now. And we have an informational hearing scheduled on the contents of Senate Bill 965 and House Bill 3470A, Carbon Pricing Solutions. I don't know if our Senate Republican colleagues will be able to be here today. They are in a caucus meeting at the moment.
Strategizing.
On an issue that we are taking up when we go back to the floor at 4:30. And we do have to go to the floor at 4:30, so we do need to hold the timelines today. So we are going to have, we've structured this committee hearing to have a series of panels, and we will allow time for questions and answers at the end of each panel. So we'll invite the panelists up, one person speaks, next person speaks, and after everybody on the panel has spoken, then members of the committee are free to ask questions as we see fit, seek clarification, opinions, et cetera, et cetera. So with that, I want to start with Julia Olson and Sean Penrith. You guys could both come forward.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And let me apologize for I'm in the process of decompressing from my last meeting. So I'm here, we're present, the meeting's going. Welcome. I'm trying to smile more.
It's
been a big day. I've had two big meetings since our floor session, so.
Well, thank you.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Julia Olson. I'm the Executive Director of Our Children's Trust. And I want to thank you for taking the time, especially after your stressful day, to hold this informational session on the singular issue that threatens every facet of our lives, including our economy, our property, our prosperity, and frankly, the ultimate habitability of the state of Oregon. I want to lead off this session by addressing why this committee and each one of you personally should do everything you can to both cap and price carbon this legislative session. It has been 50 years since a key report from President Lyndon Johnson, this book right here, warned that the rising levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would heat our planet to such an extent that marked changes would occur that would be outside of our control to deal with. Their team of scientific advisors 50 years ago said that carbon dioxide could cause extraordinary economic and human consequences to climate. We've lost 5 decades of inaction on this issue and the lost opportunity to provide for the safety and prosperity of our citizens. And we've already reached dangerous levels of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. If you look at economic costs as an indicator of distress, please consider that by 2020, the cost to Oregon from climate disruption will amount to $3.3 billion a year, and that's the equivalent of about $2,000 per household. If you're concerned about our economy, you'll act now to protect the natural infrastructure that sustains it. If you're concerned about jobs for Oregonians, you'll act now to put Oregon on the path to the inevitable jobs of the future. Carbon pricing is estimated to increase jobs in Oregon by about 20,000. If you care about children and their safety and their health, you'll act now to safeguard the resources on which every human life depends. And if you strive for social justice in your lawmaking, you'll act now to protect the poor communities and communities of color that are disproportionately disadvantaged by the impacts of climate disruption. I don't think there are any excuses not to act this session, and I want to give you some good news. So a supermajority of Oregonians support you, including your constituents. They want you to take strong action now. And this support comes from diverse business support, diverse civil society support, local governments. And before you, you have some of these stories today in this booklet and a couple of letters, both from NGOs and businesses across the state. So I encourage you to look at that. You also have the support from California. You have support from British Columbia. You have support from the northeastern states that have priced carbon and countries around the world. You have other important pressing issues, and I understand that. In fact, today you're dealing with one of them. What's different about climate disruption is that legislative delay threatens the welfare of all future generations of Oregonians, and I don't think we can say that about any other issue. Later generations will not have the opportunity to reverse climate change, and they will be irreversibly burdened with the catastrophic consequences of it. By 2050, when our temperatures are 5 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than they are today, and that's a low estimate, and our snowpack is gone, we won't be able to change course. And unfortunately, the heating that gets locked into the system is happening today. So you all, you're in this very special place where you may be remembered as the last legislators of Oregon who had the opportunity to create a safe climate future. And I speak on behalf of all children and the voiceless generations to come after us when I ask you to avoid falling into the easy, complacent trap of thinking that our greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon are insignificant and don't matter on the global scale, or that what we do here doesn't matter. And I ask you to consider that we are part of a Pacific bloc that forms one of the largest economies in the world. And our leadership matters. It matters immensely. And our pollution matters immensely. So what you do this session can become a model for other states. It can become a model for the federal government. It can become a model for countries. And there's power in that. So I don't say this lightly when I say that this is the most important job you have on your plate this legislative session. And I want to thank you for your time and thank you for your service to our state, to children, and to future generations of Oregonians.
Thank you, Julia.
You're welcome.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sean Penrith. I'm the Executive Director for the Climate Trust. We're a Portland-based NGO. And for the past 18 years, we've been managing a carbon investment fund on behalf of regulated utilities that comply with the Oregon CO2 standard. We are the oldest carbon entity in America. We work in both the voluntary markets and the compliance markets. The two major carbon pricing mechanisms are carbon cap and trade and carbon taxation. Both systems are designed to attach a price to the negative effects of carbon pollution and thereby incentivize emission reductions. The most basic difference between the two, however, is what is constrained. Either the emissions are constrained or the price. A well-designed cap and trade program provides caps, a known quantity of emissions, and therefore a more predictable metric to assess greenhouse gas reduction outcomes. The experiences of other jurisdictions and our research suggest that a cap and trade system is easier to harmonize across multiple jurisdictions than a carbon tax. Examining other carbon mechanisms from around the world, we have concluded that emission reductions and positive economic impact are not mutually exclusive. In the US, we have the benefit of two major carbon pricing mechanisms currently underway. Both of them are using a cap and trade approach. The first is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is a collaborative between 9 northeastern states to cap and reduce CO2 emissions. I'm going to jump to the larger one, which is the California cap and trade system under Assembly Bill AB 32. California's cap and trade program has been extremely successful from an economic perspective. The state added 491,000 jobs in the program's first 18 months. What's interesting about this is a 3.5% growth rate, which outpaces the 2.5% national average. This is while they're implementing AB 32. The GDP grew during the first 2 years of the program, while capped emissions dropped 4%. California has added more jobs than any other state during the economic recovery. It has also attracted $21 billion in venture capital investment, more than all other states in the country combined. While its core clean economy grew 10 times faster than any other sector in the state. Such venture-funded innovation would not be seen under a carbon tax or a pure dividend plan, in our opinion. Total cap and trade revenue in California passed $1.6 billion mark. Like Reggie, this is earlier than they expected. California estimates to auction roughly 36% of all its auction permits, which will generate $12 billion in revenue. Regardless of whether a state has a tax or a cap and trade, there is tremendous opportunity to leverage the revenues from either system. To bypass such an opportunity severely inhibits the nurturing of a vital low-carbon economy and ultimately decrease employment opportunities as the imposition of a carbon mechanism gets underway. California mandates all revenue raised from auction permits must be spent on climate mitigation, which supports their serious efforts to manage their emissions. They invest a portion of the revenue in programs and projects that reduce greenhouse gas emissions and mitigate the direct health effects of climate change for the most impacted and disadvantaged communities. Investments fall into three broad categories: sustainable communities and clean transportation, energy efficiency and clean energy, natural resources and water. 25% of the investment proceeds are to be invested directly to benefit disadvantaged communities that bear the brunt of pollution. A full dividend approach has seemed to offer problems in our research, and targeted reinvestment of carbon revenues is highly recommended. A direct dividend fails to mitigate direct climate impacts or provide long-term sustainability to underserved and underrepresented communities. BC in Canada offers a great example. Because the revenues are used to offset taxes and are not supporting direct environmental greenhouse gas reduction projects, it is now causing some doubt as to the effectiveness of that program. And in fact, many groups up there are asking or advocating to do away with the revenue neutrality aspect and use the revenues directly to support a low-carbon development. To conclude, experiences from other operating carbon mechanisms prove that it's possible to institute pollution reduction programs without compromising economic prosperity or social equity. Based on the California model, careful design of a targeted reinvestment plan to ensure a low-carbon infrastructure is built and disadvantaged communities receive active investment is instructive for us here. We believe an effective carbon pricing policy will be one that ensures that the state meets its emission reduction targets and allows linkage to other states, market mechanisms, and targeted reinvestment. House Bill 3470 asks the Department of DEQ to design just such a mechanism to reach Oregon's existing climate goals, which could open the door for Oregon to join California and other regions in their cap-and-trade systems. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. Questions? I have a couple of questions, but...
You go ahead, Ron.
Okay. So you mentioned, Sean, you mentioned growth rates in California. Could you touch on those again? I was typing as fast as I can.
That's okay.
I'm not that.
That's right. So during the first 18 months of the program, the state generated 491,000 jobs. Their GDP grew while emissions dropped, so thereby proving that the economic impact that's often cited as a negative, it can actually be decoupled from a carbon mechanism or carbon pricing.
And then, Julia, you mentioned, you specifically said a supermajority supports us taking action. What type of, I mean, without getting like really specific, are you talking 95%? Are you talking three-fifths?
Yeah, I mean, the polls show that over 70% of Oregonians, and Tom Bowerman can give you the precise figures, but support action on climate change. And then in some more limited polling done on the House Bill 3470, it shows that over 60% support a bill of that nature.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. So I have a question for each of you. Julia, just following up on that, the polling shows that there is, you know, a lot of support, but the polling also shows that decarbonization is not the top issue for people, right? And so when they're asked, is this important, they say yes. But in terms of it being on their agenda of most pressing issues, it's not. And so how do we get to that point where, not only is it getting broad support, but it is a real priority? Because, you know, frankly, that's what it takes to get the legislature to move, to have people who are saying, this is, you cannot leave this session without taking action on this.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think sometimes legislators have to lead. I think we have enough public support for you to do what you're going to do, and I think the people will support you and reelect you, honestly. But if if you look at the civil rights era, there was 30% public support for the decisions that were being made in the time at that time. And it still took the leadership of judges and Congress to really uphold the equal rights of African Americans. So I think sometimes you need to lead, even if you're afraid of public support. But I think public support backs you here very strongly. And the other thing I would say is that when people are worried about jobs or the economy or the health of their kids, all of these things are related to climate. So you can tell that story and you can link those topics. What they may be worried about is directly a function of what's happening with the changing climate, like drought, for instance.
Thank you. And Sean, good seeing you again. One of the attractions for some people of cap and trade is that it can generate revenues that can be used for things other than decarbonization, right? Once there are revenues being raised, there's going to be a sort of impulse to put them somewhere away. And so has this been a danger in California, for example? Is that a risk? Or is that something that we should be taking seriously as we do craft whatever kind of carbon pricing plan we come up with?
It is a risk. The careful design of the plan definitely needs to take into account that question. In California, the mandate is that auction revenues go to climate mitigation. However, as you well know, Governor Brown did borrow some money from the revenue proceeds, which he repaid. But for all intents and purposes, it's targeted for climate mitigation, and that includes the communities, smart infrastructure, energy efficiency, and so on. So I would heartily recommend that that's the boundary that you put on proceeds.
And just a follow-up, have they been doing anything with setting funds for worker retraining? Because that's a real concern, that industries are going to be disrupted and workers are going to be moved from, well-paid jobs to low-paid service jobs.
Right. And that's a real danger, and that's why the ability to target the investment of the proceeds is super important to build up that skill set. To answer your question, yes, they have. So the clean core economy that grew in California was largely attributed to this, and there's a great number of subsidies that support PV installers and inspectors and verifiers and so on, which are subsidies that come out of auction proceeds.
The questions of this panel? Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Next, we are going to call forward our one opposition panel. These folks have a little bit different perspective, I think, probably. Mike Fries, Edward Finkley, and Ian Tollison.
Good afternoon, Senator Edwards and members of the committee. I'm Ed Finkley. I'm the executive director of the Northwest Industrial Gas Users. My members use natural gas in their businesses in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We're pulp and paper companies. We're specialty metal companies. We make computer chips. We're aerospace, chemicals, wood products. But natural gas is a key cost input for all of our businesses. Our members support measures to reduce carbon emissions in Oregon. We share the concerns of the proponents of these bills about the rising carbon dioxide emissions worldwide. And our members are proud to be leaders in energy efficiency. We think Oregon has been a leader for many years and should continue to be. We do, however, oppose Senate Bill 965 and House Bill 3470A. We've commissioned a study to determine the economy-wide cost of pricing carbon emissions in Oregon for natural gas consumers. If you assume $30 a ton, that's nearly $400 million for natural gas consumers statewide, or about a 20% increase in the price of natural gas. And our concern drills down to two primary areas. energy-intensive trade-dependent industries and their workers would be in the crosshairs of any such measure. And frankly, individuals that use above the average amount of energy commuting to work or heating their homes would be in a similar situation to energy-intensive trade-dependent businesses. And so we think that carbon pricing, while great in theory, raises serious equity concerns. One business or individual gets a tax break, somebody else gets a large net tax increase, assuming you do it revenue neutral. If you take the approach of California, then everybody gets a tax increase, essentially. Oregon needs to retain its current manufacturers, and we need to attract new businesses in our state, both for middle-class job creation and for CO2 emissions. Our state is rightfully proud to be a real leader in carbon reductions. Our carbon footprint of our businesses is far less than it is in Texas or China or Georgia or Southeast Asia. So bringing businesses here and keeping them here is actually a carbon solution, and we think one that's very effective. We don't want to be part of driving manufacturing away from Oregon. We want to be part of driving it to Oregon so that it's done the environmentally responsible way. We think it's a little early to conclude what the results in California and British Columbia have been, especially for the manufacturing sector. British Columbia had to exempt their nurseries and their cement manufacturers after they started losing businesses once the carbon tax got to $30. California, while I concur with the previous speaker's comments about overall GDP, they lag in manufacturing, far behind even the U.S. numbers. The U.S. manufacturing has grown 7.5% since January of 2010. California is up 1.9%. So I hear from California manufacturers that high energy costs are already slowing their manufacturing sector, and it has because their energy costs are higher than Oregon to start with, and we have a stronger manufacturing sector up here than they have in California. So I would be cautious in thinking that we don't have more to lose by doing this than California had to start with, or that California somehow has escaped the impact of the carbon price. And their carbon price is $15 or a little less than that for their allowances at the moment. BC, the other problem with using BC as an example is they're a 90% hydro economy, so the electric impacts are not going to be comparable. We think carbon pricing has a place, and its place is at the federal level to be both effective and fair from state to state. So we think about what Oregon should do, and we think there's four areas that we should concentrate on. First, energy efficiency, where we're already a leader. We should continue to do more of that. Second, we should encourage individuals and businesses to use natural gas where appropriate instead of coal and oil, because you reduce carbon emissions by 50% with coal and 25% with oil. We should continue renewable developments, turning this the grid in Oregon into even more of a renewable one is a good thing to be doing. And then finally, we should look for ways to fund research into game-changing technologies, things that would really decarbonize the global economy, such as grid-level battery storage. And maybe Oregon should be part of that. One of the things you did in the 2013 session that we're supportive of is Senate Bill 844, which is encouraging your gas utilities to use voluntary carbon reduction measures. And one of the ones we're focusing on right now is combined heat and power, where we could put CHP in an industry where they would use the steam both for electric generation and for industrial steam use. Very efficient way to use natural gas, lowers carbon emissions. Those kinds of programs have made Oregon a leader already, and we think you should continue to be a leader. But we would urge you to think and act globally in combating carbon dioxide emissions, and we don't think SB 965 or HB 3470 do that. So that's why we're opposed to them, and we look forward to a dialogue on this issue in the years to come. I thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ian Tollison. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Northwest Food Processors Association. We represent food processors in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. from, you know, cheese, dairy, vegetables, fruits, nuts, the gamut of the crops that are found on Oregon's farms, and we turn that into the final product that you find on the grocery stores. Our association is, while we're opposed to both of these bills in principle, I think the idea behind them of reducing our reliance on carbon intensity fuels is a good idea. Where the problem that we have with these concepts is that with a state taking over the price of carbon, that would only drive our food processors to look elsewhere, to more attractive places. Food processors are in Oregon and in Washington and Idaho for a variety of reasons. First and foremost, our agricultural community provides a really diverse set of crops, and our food processors need to be close to that. That's helpful. But we do not have to be. Our transportation center, our customer base in the U.S., is really on the East Coast. So there is a cost associated with that. We are an export state, so we don't only export our goods to the East Coast. We also go globally. And these are dollars that we bring back into the state. We estimate here in Oregon alone that we bring in about $2 billion of money into the state. And we employ roughly about 27,000 Oregonians in our processing facilities. And these jobs provide a living wage. They're much more than the current minimum wage and much more than other ideas of how that would be increased. We oftentimes in our plants, we have people that have stayed there for many years. It's really a family atmosphere, and they value these jobs here. Food processors, we've been voluntarily taking actions to use energy as efficient as possible. In 2009, NWFPA was the first industry group in the U.S. to set a industry-wide goal to reduce our energy intensity by 25% in 10 years and 50% in 20 years. And I'm just happy to report to you that we are on track to meet that goal. Food processors need reliable and inexpensive energy. Our activities are baking, cooking, freezing, dehydrating. We use large amounts of energy. But we feel some responsibility to try to curb that as much as possible. So part of our energy program, if you will, is teaching other industry members in our association how to be more effectively as possible. So we have a few documents that we put out to our membership to try to get at that goal, and I just want to give you a brief summary of each one of these. Our first is our NWFPA Energy Roadmap. This provides a pathway and guidance for companies to reduce their energy intensity, and we measure this, the amount of energy used per pound of product. Through this goal setting and implementation of a strategic energy management plan, we're able to reduce that. Our sustainability guide is a step-by-step guide to assist processors to create or refine an individualized sustainability program that they can curtail to each individual company. Not every company is the same. We produce many different types of food products, and there are certain ways to cut energy in particular ways without sacrificing food safety. Food safety is our number one goal, and in order to do that, we need to have processes in line to kill bacteria, and that oftentimes requires heating and cooling. So arbitrary greenhouse gas reduction numbers can really have the ability to sacrifice a lot of these processes. And then finally, we have our sustainability micro case study guide. This really is a collection of best practices that have been used in the industry so we can learn from one another. They're short, easy-to-read snippets that a food processing company can look at, hear from what another company is doing. You got to be careful because sometimes there are competitors, but we realize this is really a shared goal and that we need to help one another get here. And so this in total helps our members reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And finally, I just want to leave with, I started this conversation talking about why we're here, good agricultural crops. You know, we're close to the Pacific Rim. But we don't have to be. It is actually quite easy for a company to move production in and out of the state. While we represent processors in the three states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, it is very common that they operate in California or Kentucky or Michigan, Ohio, some of these other hotbeds that are closer to the U.S. customer base. And I can't tell you how many times I've talked to a processor who's concerned with, you know, increasing that cost of production and them saying, well, you know, we can shift that production elsewhere. And I think that's something all of us don't want to see. So I just want to give that word of caution that we value the goal stated here, but we feel the arbitrary nature in these reduction numbers really put us at a competitive disadvantage. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Fries representing Associated Oregon Industries. We represent roughly 1,500 businesses that employ nearly 200,000 employees. And we appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 965 and House Bill 3470. It's become clear, and I think even more clear, that Oregon employers and employees value a clean and efficient economy and work hard to continue that. And that's partly why they choose not only to live in Oregon, but to do business in Oregon. And we also recognize that this is becoming a hot topic for public debate, not only in this committee, but outside of the legislature. And we're happy to be part of that conversation. But there are a few principles that I think that we all need to recognize that are important, right? We do value jobs, and we value good jobs. And so any solution really has to take those factors into consideration. It also has to consider what in fact are we doing? Are we in fact reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and not just in Oregon, but in the United States and worldwide? Because if we're not, if we're just shifting that, then why are Oregonians forced to bear that cost? Is it making a difference in global climate change? Obviously, as the previous panel spoke, there are real business risks. There, some folks have continually cite the risky business report. This is not lost on many, as Ian said, on many of the employers that have other places that they can do business. It must be fair and affordable for all Oregonians. So some of the policies in front of you and others that have been presented in the legislature do not seem to meet that objective. They place an unfair burden on a number of people, and it's not just business. It's all consumers, as currently drafted. Any solution also needs to engage all stakeholders and ensure that the stakeholders are engaged and understood throughout the process, not just early on, but that their input is taken into account, considered, and acted on accordingly, and allow for some flexibility to accommodate changing circumstances and technologies. As we've seen just in this legislative session, fascinating breakthrough with batteries, home batteries with Tesla. I hope and expect that those advancements will continue, and that's a good thing. That's a good thing for businesses, that's a good thing for consumers, and that's a good thing for the environment. Senate Bill 965 and House Bill 3470 do not ensure that many of those principles are met. In fact, both bills delegate nearly all the difficult decisions away from elected officials and to administrative agencies, providing little guidance or assurance for input from the most immediately impacted. That is in part why AOI has concerns with these bills, and we look forward to continued discussion around climate change and climate change proposals, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you each for your testimony. Questions for this panel? Questions? Go ahead, Senator Nebro.
And this can go to any of you. So back in 2013, the legislature commissioned a study of carbon pricing, actually specifically a carbon tax. and asked a group out of Portland State University to do the study, which was presented to us last fall. And there are no recommendations in that study. It's looking at various scenarios for, you know, different kinds of pricing. And the outcomes of the different scenarios varied. Some of them did that there were some that showed that, you know, you could do this kind of thing, put a price on carbon in a way that would not hurt employment or hurt the, you know, primary manufacturing settings. I assume you're familiar with those with that study, and I wonder if you would give us just a quick reaction to, you know, what how you respond to it, because I think most of the all of your industries, I think, were examined in these various scenarios.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro. I have read the study. In fact, I've looked at it multiple times. There are a few underlying factors that, all just to be frank, I don't completely understand some of the critiques that have been done by some of the energy sector as far as pricing and the impacts to consumers. So I won't touch on that, but it's certainly worth kind of exploring further. There are a number of things in the study that are demonstrated, and there are, and it's important on how revenues that would be collected are allocated and distributed. So under these proposals, the two bills in front of the committee do not distribute monies as either kind of recommended or show the least impact on those on our industries or businesses. So it depends upon, in part, whether or not it's in fact revenue neutral and how the monies are allocated to determine which sectors are hurt worse than others. Certainly the manufacturing sector under those scenarios had the highest cost or the highest burden as a result of the taxes. So if they don't receive any of the revenues to either change their processes, then it's certain that those manufacturing industries will likely go away or be hurt. So
I'll just take a few comments. You know, I'm not as familiar with the study, so here we go. You know, the term revenue neutral, you know, there are some aspects of other ideas I've seen of a tax and then getting it back in the form of a tax credit or something like that. I assume that's what you mean. You know, for our members that operate in multiple states, you know, they have operations in Oregon, and they look at a system like that, and that is really an anomaly in their business model that I think would create an unnecessary hardship. And the totality of all the current business legislation, I think just adds one more piece to that picture that would really discourage growth investment in Oregon in my industry that I represent. So while it may be revenue neutral on paper, it's just one more hurdle that really disincentivizes our ability to operate a successful business here.
Maybe I could just, can I just
quickly
address that? So you know, we heard from Ms. Olson in the first panel that Oregon need not act in isolation here. You know, it could act in concert with, you know, British Columbia, Washington, California, in which case, you know, that danger of leakage and, you know, being a place where, you know, companies will flee from because of we're doing things differently. I mean, there's also a possibility of doing things in concert with them, which could really help our economy in some forms. No.
I would agree, Senator Dembro, Mr. Chair. You know, spread the pain, right? If everyone has to do it, it has an equalizing effect. That's why I would say, you know, Ed spoke about having the ability of the entire U.S. look at that. We'd much rather have that than have an Oregon-only system. Again, while we do, our association has specifically Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, we have members operating throughout the country. Even here in Salem, which is kind of a hotbed of food processors, we have people that have their operations in Kentucky or whatever, and it's very easy to shift that production. Now, they don't want to. They have ties to Oregon. They want to be here. But in a world in which you shared that pain, I think that would be a lot easier to operate successfully.
I guess I just want to follow up. Sharing the pain, that just seems like we're pulling teeth or something. It seems to me if you're wanting to bring business here, you want to have more opportunities to locate. There is going to be demands on energy, needs to actually have those operations. And if you can actually find a means to actually accomplish that without having the impact that carbon-based systems have now, why would that be painful to do? And I guess I just also follow up on that is the reason why people would be that are operating businesses here just going to pull up and walk out from their source of where their product is coming from. They're going to go to the cost of having carbon-fueled trains, trucks, ship product from here over to Kentucky or someplace else to be processed?
Senator Przanski, Mr. Chair, I don't want to leave you with the impression that, you know, as soon as this happens, people get up and walk away. I don't think you could look at any industry or economic model and see that. But I think it goes towards a pathway and a momentum shift that we fear. So I just want to be clear with that. To your question of what does that actually look like, and share the pain, you know, we feel that we know how to cut energy costs ourselves. It's good business practice, frankly. You know, you don't want to have to, you know, energy, you want to cut down your costs where you can. So that's something that we want to do. And we've really taken it upon ourselves to help lead our industries and our businesses to that point.
Chair Edwards.
We need to wrap this panel up because I've got some more panels that we have planned, and we've got to be back on the floor at 4:30. So I thank you each for being here. To be continued, I guess my final comment to you would be that, Mr. Finkley, I appreciate your testimony. You mentioned that energy-intensive industries will be in the crosshairs of this type of legislation. And, I mean, for some of us, it feels like we're all in the crosshairs of a warming planet. And so we're trying to figure out how to come up with some solutions, granted that you know, the U.S. Congress has not acted in a meaningful way and doesn't appear as though it's going to be acting in a meaningful way anytime soon. So,
Chair Edwards, may I just make one quick comment? That's why I think that while this conversation continues, it's critical to have business, actual business, that are heavy users of utilities and energy to be at the table. We welcome that conversation. We want to be at the table so that, you know, all these things that we talk about that could happen don't. We don't want to lose members, right? We're very concerned about that. At the same time, our members do care about the environment, and so we think we can get a win-win.
Thank you. Okay, next up we've got Tom Bowerman and Dan Golden.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I really appreciate the opportunity to address this. I certainly don't want to reiterate
your name for the record.
Oh, Tom Bowerman. I'm a businessman myself and a policy researcher, kind of in my spare time. Not to reiterate the challenge and the urgency, I just want to say what the Department of Energy reports in a draft that is sitting in the Oregon Global Warming Commission waiting for delivery to the legislature while the chair of that commission is on medical leave. Quote, we can expect Oregon's emissions in 2020 to be some 11 million metric tons in excess of the 51 million metric tons goal that the legislature has set for our state in that year, with the gap therein between performance and goals growing every year. So here we are. We know we have a problem, and the legislature, your own body, set goals in 2007, which are not being met. So
they are not arbitrary.
And they aren't arbitrary at all. They're very specific.
Okay. Sorry.
They're very specific.
I wanted to get that into the last panel, too. But.
And they were actually based on the IPCC, which is a fairly robust organization of climate scientists. So you made a good decision back there. And the decision that wasn't made was to enact a policy which required it to be met. And that's what I really want to address. 3470, just to do a very broad, quick brush of what it does, because I've been advised to talk a little bit about what it does. And, of course, there's no substitute for reading the bill itself, but this is just the broad overview. It requires the current ORS statute for greenhouse gas emission goals to be met. It requires it. It consolidates Oregon laws and rules and policies about emissions into a comprehensive framework. It assigns responsibility to the EQC and the EPA purposefully. And I will say that from my experience in trotting around the halls of this legislative session, it is very difficult for me to understand how the legislature can administer a policy such as this. And that's why Oregon, with its method of doing business, assigns policy administration to agencies that have the ability to make rules through administrative rulemaking with virtually full-time commissions that meet every month and robust staffs to be able to provide information and do research. So it authorizes a market-based trading and auction program similar to California's law AB 32. California, we know, being the seventh largest economy in the world, has designed their law to be joined by other organizations. They are like this huge snowplow that has developed a very workable solution and has now, in 3 years, been demonstrating very stellar performance in lowering their emissions and achieving economic performance, as Sean Penrith addressed. And it provides a policy framework which is supported by a majority of organizations. And in the handout I gave you, if you would flip it all the way over the two-page, flip it to the back, Chair, I believe you referred to evidence from Oregonians on this. And you can see in the first two charts a before and after. We listed the components of the policy itself in eight different questions, approximately 64% to 30%, so more than 2-to-1 support. And if you know the way that we do our surveying, you'll know that this is not push polling. And when I send you, or it is listed on OLIS now as submitted testimony, those blue lines are hot links so you can get to the full survey to analyze it in your own comfort and look at the breadth of the questions and how we approach that to determine the level of public support drawn statistically sampling Oregon registered voters, balanced for the primary demographics like age, political party, geographic representation, and gender. So it's a good survey. We expect this act to be self-supporting through auction authorizations based upon the performance of the other jurisdictions which are practicing it, using the open market mechanism. Most likely, we expect, after the agency goes through hearings and rulemaking, because it points so strongly in that direction, through the Western Climate Initiative, which Oregon is already a full partner in, that is becoming linked to the fifth largest economy in the world and also the world's largest carbon market that is currently working. I project, based upon evidence from these other jurisdictions, that by 2018, if this were passed this term,
This act will be providing at least $250 million per year for investments in clean infrastructure, boost the economic consequences in Oregon, and ameliorate impacts on vulnerable low-income people. So I was asked to draw some distinctions, if there are any, between 3470 and Senate Bill 965. And you will see there in the front page of the handout that I gave you a matrix which attempts to do that. But I just want to hit 3 points and then close. HB 3470 is a flexible performance policy based and reached via commission adoption through Oregon administrative rules. But it retains flexibility in its design with a series of components such as five-year checkups with adjustments accordingly, because this is going to be a moving target for the rest of my grandchildren's lives, and we're going to have to be adjusting all the time. This is not something that does very well with legislative rulemaking. It is going to be a fluid process. While 965 is a comparatively rigid, prescriptive legislative policy lacking rolling flexibility. The next point is 3470 enables a market mechanism with revenue reinvestments in non-fossil fuel futures. 3365 refunds through prescription revenue to all taxpayers and their dependents in equal proportions. And we think, based upon the research that we've done, and Sean Penrith touched on this too, that the far leading outcomes for changing and growing into decoupling from fossil fuels through the next 35 to 50 years comes through reinvesting, so that we actually establish the pathway that is required with a lot of infrastructural investments. And the third point is random sampling of Oregon registered voters finds HB 3470 methodology supported by over a 2-to-1 ratio, with support for reinvestment running almost 3-to-1 over the refund, as you saw in the third chart on that flip side. And I will leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the overview.
Dan, go ahead. Thank you for having me, Honorable Chair, Senator Edwards, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Golden, and I'm honored to speak on behalf of SB 965. Great, we have a PowerPoint. Terrific. I'm going to review some of my prepared statements quickly, because I know that I want to be sensitive to people speaking after me, and the you know, I know you have to be on the floor at 4:30, but please, if I'm speaking too quickly, just sit, just okay. You'll just jump in and interrupt. I work professionally as an engineer and an economist in the energy efficiency industry, and in my free time, I serve as policy director for Oregon Climate. We are a statewide network comprising more than 1,800 members, unified in our conviction that Oregon can build the model for fair and effective climate policy. SB 965 is the model. So I open many of my presentations with this chart, and I won't dwell on it for long because I spoke about it already during the House Energy and Environment hearing on April 14th, but it tells a powerful story about our global relationship with fossil fuels, and I want especially to highlight 2 points. First, by any reasonable measure, we're losing. Right, that red line represents fossil fuel consumption, and it's going up at an alarming rate in an unrestrained way. Global consumption of renewable energy is growing at a historic rate, but global consumption of fossil fuels is growing 9 times faster. And you can see the reference to renewable energy is the green line down at the bottom. Now, we've all heard disingenuous pundits on the East Coast argue that heavy snow or a cold winter is somehow proof that climate change must be a hoax. And, you know, I might just as well claim that world hunger is over because I just ate lunch. But when I look at this data... When I look at this data, I sometimes worry that we're all guilty of the same fallacy. Our Facebook feed suggests that solar roadways and Tesla's new toy for rich people are poised to replace fossil fuels, but that only makes sense if we selectively report on 1 year in one sector and one region with one fuel type. Our global energy economy is no more localized than the global climate, and we all consume iPhones and flat screens burning American coal in China, and we all share one atmosphere. So while renewable technologies are more promising than ever, they're not really a plan to get off of fossil fuels. Simply put, there's no relationship between renewable energy consumption and fossil fuel independence. But the data also tells us what does work, and that's increasing the price of fossil fuels. Consumption of fossil fuels only actually dropped three times in history: the 1973 oil crisis, the 1979 crisis, energy crisis, and the Great Recession. All of them have the same thing in common: a reduction in the purchasing power of fossil fuels. Both HB 3470 and SB 965 would accomplish this goal because capping emissions will drive up the price on fossil fuels. Any cap and trade policy, including SB 965, must start with the auction of carbon allowances. But what happens with the proceeds? And that's one of the key differences between these two bills. The intuitive thing would be to reinvest in renewable energy, but these data invite me to revisit that intuition. SB 965, as my esteemed colleague here pointed out, would require that all the revenue be evenly distributed to all Oregonians in the form of an annual dividend. And it's not just for one reason. First of all, the scientifically meaningful reductions prescribed in SB 965 and HB 3470 would be very difficult for low-income families who spend a relatively high fraction of their income on energy. The best science suggests that these reductions would bring gasoline prices to $12 per gallon by the end of the century. The 100% dividend guarantees that any person consuming less than the average amount of carbon would get more money back than they would spend each year. This means a progressive policy and not a regressive one. Secondly, since the data are telling us to stick with the carbon price, the dividend gives us our own internal insurance policy, something like the Alaska Permanent Fund. Every year, the state of Alaska collects a lease from the oil companies drilling on the North Slope, and then they distribute the money evenly to all Alaskans. Big Oil regularly tries to take down the Alaska Permanent Fund, but they can't. Alaskans just love getting that dividend check too much. So, you know, I mean, as my esteemed colleague pointed out, the polling shows that the dividend isn't as popular as reinvestment. You know, I would evoke the great Henry Ford, who once said, if I'd asked my customers what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse, right? I mean, this is a 100-year plan. It's not what we're doing today. So we have to be ready for the titans of fossil fuels to attack our carbon price, and just as they did in Australia and succeeded, and we know exactly how to stop them, even after you've all left office, and that's a 100% dividend. Now, finally, and most importantly, we must think clearly about this revenue before anyone becomes dependent on it. Now, this chart projects the revenue Oregon would raise with a law like SB 965 or HB 3450. Now, for a number of reasons, you really can't avoid raising this revenue because these permits will have value and they will create scarcity as you move down the supply curve and up the demand curve. These data are derived from a model that REMI built, similar to the NERC study that you may all be familiar with, and it shows how revenue would change over time. Now, at first, allowance auctions would raise little or no money. We'd be issuing so many allowances that they wouldn't be very viable. But as they become scarcer, as an SB 965 prescribes an 85% reduction below 1990 levels by 2050, they'll start to gain value until 2030, when the revenue peaks out at $5 billion per year. At that point, the value of permits would continue to rise, but it would be offset by the decreased volume of permits. We must ultimately allow for zero carbon dioxide emissions, so it has to go all the way down to the bottom. And at that point, it doesn't matter how much a permit is worth, because if we auction none of them, we get no revenue. So the reason I bring this up, and the reason I say it's the most important point, and the reason why we strongly believe that the dividend is worth prescribing right now, is that we've seen this movie before. We've become dependent on tobacco revenues in order to sponsor our healthcare. We've become dependent on timber revenues to sponsor schools. We've become dependent on lottery revenues, which is essentially a tax on low-income Oregonians. And once we're hooked to that, we can't get rid of it. And ultimately, how is that different from really the story of why climate change is happening in the first place? It's not that the fossil fuel companies have so much money. They don't, right? When you compare the amount of money that the fossil fuel industry has compared with the amount of money we all stand to lose for not doing anything with climate change, it's not that much. It's that all the value that we stand to lose is much more dispersed, and theirs is more concentrated. And this is, you know, you can look at this story. You show me a problem in democracy, and I'll show you a place where concentrated stakeholdership is being leveraged to perpetuate the status quo. Now, when we raise this price and it raises energy prices on consumers, if we don't redistribute that as a dividend, we'll be concentrating that oil money further, not less. And when we distribute it as a dividend, we disperse it. We create universal stakeholdership so that lots and lots of people have this revenue. So you can see at the peak, yeah, that dividend is going to get smaller too. And yes, Oregonians are going to dislike it. And yes, it's going to be hard to get over that peak when that dividend starts to get smaller. But at least at that point, we won't have our entire state or some industry dependent on it. At least at that point, the concentration of stakeholdership won't be concentrated anymore. It'll be dispersed, and it'll be harder to be able to get rid of it. Now, you can see there are a number of examples of fossil fuel of taxes on fossil fuels, of carbon taxes in other states and countries. And you can see that, you know, looking at where they fit in, within the framework of this REMI data, none of them have even Sweden and Switzerland, which is up to $135 per ton, none of them are even close to this peak. And I think the reasonable expectation is that as they raise more revenue and as they get more revenue from fossil fuels and that stakeholdership in their government becomes more concentrated on them, they're never going to be able to get past that top of the curve. They can't get to zero. We regard, and this is the reason why all the biggest names nationally support this proposition. You know, why the James Hansons, the Bill McKibbins, the, you know, Robert Reich and you know, Hank Paulson and George Shultz, you know, all these names, they say it's got to be a dividend because it's the only way to protect low-income families, protect the policy for a while, and then keep it feasible that you could get down to zero without building new dependencies on it. And more to the point, aren't we really here to build a model? I mean, you know, the opposition panel clearly pointed out Oregon doesn't have that big of a contribution to global climate change. You know, if we have a contribution, it's the same thing that, you know, California gave in terms of, you know, the Clean Air Act and what Massachusetts gave in terms of the Affordable Care Act. All of our major legislation follows the state. We need a state to be able to prove this model. But what will we be proving if all we've done is taken the money away from the fossil fuel companies and instead become dependent on it inside our state? What really will it show when we say that money is, that's blood money, it's poisonous, you can't spend it, and instead, oh, we'd like to spend it now? We think that really proving the model of effective climate legislation means committing to that bipartisanship. From the very time that you even start talking about it in an informational hearing, we're making the commitment. This is not designed to raise revenue. This is not designed to support bigger government. This is designed to control fossil fuels, to disperse the stakeholdership, and really, really create a predictable transition for the next era of energy consumption. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Brzozowski.
Dan, sitting and listening, I'm almost thinking you're making an argument that, to me, is going to take us down the same road we've gone with the kicker. It's kind of like, unfortunately, we've had the Republicans in their time in 1999 actually put into the Constitution. Now we can't ever have that conversation. So now we know this money that's there that could be reinvested in multiple ways, and on the general fund perspective, is no longer there unless we hit some soft spot. And it seems to me, why wouldn't we, if we're really wanting to make these type of changes in our energy consumption and impact the environment that we have and pass on for future generations, what's wrong with having that money that would be coming out from the proposal of 3470 and having it reinvested to continue this growth and cycle? It seems to me we would be benefiting generations further down the road as compared to having people say, that's mine, I want it. And I understand that they're going to potentially spin it back into the communities and in our state, but have we been short-sighted, as I feel we were, as to how the kicker is now not able to actually use money where in this day and time today we're looking at trying to shore up these various budgets that would have more impact on families and kids?
Honorable Chair, Senator Brzozowski, thank you for the question. And I totally, absolutely share your initial impression about the kicker. And I think, you know, I think it's worth noting that it really is philosophically an entirely different idea. You know, the kicker, you know, it's killing us because we have noise in the way that our revenue performs. And when times are good, we can't do anything about it. When times are bad, we're kind of SOL. You know, I think that this is something really different, right? This is, you know, we're building a model here. The idea is to build a model. It's not about our 0.5% of contribution of greenhouse gas emissions, right? It's about our ability to actually prove climate change is not an elaborate hoax to grow the government or to finance some kind of a new program, you know? And I mean, I think that if we wanted to go a reinvestment route and if that were a model that were going to work, it already would be working in California. You know, it hasn't really changed the debate. You still hear the same talking points nationally. It's that everyone suspects this is going to be, you know, this is going to be a way to, you know, to grow our government. And, you know, what I would suggest is start with a price signal, you know, see what happens inside investment markets because they're going to change. You know, I mean, if once you have this level of predictability that only you can get from something like the Alaska Permanent Fund, investors will change their behavior. And once that happens, if we need to look at maybe there should be some way that we can finance this with government action, that would be great. But we shouldn't do it with a regressive tax. And that's what a carbon tax would be without a dividend. The dividend is the only way to make it progressive instead of regressive. Is that
one follow up?
Yeah, follow up.
I guess growing government, to me, I don't see this as a process to grow government. What I see is a means to actually set a model get a reduction in the carbon impact that we're having, and then taking the money that comes from that and continuing down the road of taking the change on the environment as to what we consider are going to be and already showing to be detrimental in climate change, et cetera. So I don't buy that the analysis that somehow this is growing government as much as taking care and having a direct impact on the environment as to the negatives that are now impacting us to the level that they are. Thank you.
Question?
Yes, yeah. Thanks. In terms of the plan for how the dividends would be distributed, they would go out to Oregon households, in a progressive manner or sort of just in a equal shares or more going to people who are negatively affected by the the cost of energy. How is that being projected?
Honorable Chair and Senator Denborough, thank you for the question, and it's a very good question. Right now, it's prescribed just even dividend goes back to everybody. The idea there, though, is that while low-income families spend a higher fraction of their income on energy, in an absolute sense, they spend less. So the best research, the best forecasts show that two-thirds of low-income Americans, two-thirds of Oregonians in the lowest end of the income spectrum would actually get more money back in revenue than they would spend in their dividend. Now, we could try to skew that to be even more progressive. You know, to me, I feel like this is already arguably will be one of the more progressive income distribution schemes, in recent history. But I would say that there's a big benefit to making it simple, to not turning this into an agency that has to allocate who gets the money, to not turning it into another covered organ. You know, SB 965 has a mechanism that already exists. It uses essentially the Department of Revenue to distribute checks in a simple, non-mathematical way to anybody that filed a tax return in Oregon and that has a dependent. So we believe that the simplicity and transparency of that outweighs the potential benefits that we could get from an increase subtly and how progressive it already is. But that, let's make an amendment,
Yeah. Well, just to follow up, I think we do, obviously, as you say, low-income people are paying more in energy costs than others. And, some of that is due to the fact that they're living in homes that are, not as weatherproof. They're driving cars that are not as fuel efficient. They don't have the resources currently to invest in those upgrades that will save them money. And it really does seem to me that whatever program we land on needs to take that into account and make sure that they're being helped so that, they have the assistance in a way that it doesn't become an ongoing negative burden on them with respect to others.
Well, Senator Denborough, I believe that being poor in America means knowing exactly what everything costs, and nobody knows how to make a budget like somebody who's struggling month to month like that. If you're losing $400 a month in heating because you're under-insulated, I think, empirically, and I can tell you this because I work in energy efficiency, if these folks get that lump sum, and the best science estimates, it would rise somewhere, by 2020 to about $500 to $1,500 a year. If they get that sum, the reasonable expectation is they're going to spend it to make those savings, and they'll be in a better position to do it. And I believe in the capacity of low-income Americans to be able to make those choices wisely.
Tom?
To the issue of growing government, on request of Representative Barnhart, the DEQ analyzed 3470 and estimated that it's going to be 3.5 FTEs for the administration of that policy. For the issue of low-income people, if the rulemaking process adopted it the similar way that California did, they direct 25% of the revenues from the auction allocations to low-income people to ameliorate the predictable consequences of these changes on them because they have the least amount of flexibility to adjust appropriately to the changes. And I could go into more detail on that. We've looked at that. But that is a justice approach. And 3470 in the amendments, which are on the hot links to the document that I gave you, also includes the Oregon Environmental Justice Commission being directly involved in the rulemaking to ensure that low-income people are appropriately addressed
addressed in the rulemaking structure. I'd also say that to the comment from the industry reps about, and this is a really key and important part, about firms exiting the state because of the pressures of costs. The way California did that in the allocations of the permits is that when they're subjected to exiting, when they're not captive, they basically get a free pass. But their caps are still coming down, but they don't have to pay into the program to for the pricing mechanism. And that seems to be working well. The escaping, the leakage is not occurring there. And it's all part of a fairly well-established and very elegantly designed policy. And it's what we really attempted to do in addressing it without defining it all, because we think that we need to go through the process of designing that with a specific Oregon face, with a with an Oregon personality about it, but not having it go through all of the nuances in the legislative process we think are better assigned to an agency, whether it be the DEQ or otherwise. But I just wanted to address those things that I had heard so that at least we aren't operating in fear that the naysayers will have that it can never work here.
Thank you both. This is very thought-provoking ideas. What I encourage with whatever we develop, whatever comes out of this, I hope that folks that are in this room and listening on the internet and that care about this issue greatly will learn how to come behind whatever we end up developing, because I can tell you that the distance between you guys is not nearly as far as the distance
Absolutely.
Between you and the opponents. And I couldn't get the votes to close a loophole in the emissions performance standard this year, which should have been an easy lift. So I'm just saying, you know, we need to have these intellectual discussions, and we need to, but at the end of the day, we need to come out with the policy that we think is the best combination of good policy, and that we can get it through this legislative process. So I appreciate truly both of your input on this. Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Senator Edwards. Thank you.
Next up, and we've got 7.5 minutes apiece, uh-huh. and then we need to go to the floor, the Senate floor. We've got Dr. Philip Harding and Kristen Eberhard.
I have slides too.
Okay. Honorable Chair Edwards and committee members, forgive me for any nervousness. This is my first time ever appearing in a room, let alone as a speaker. I committed yesterday, and it's a great honor and privilege to be here. My name is Philip Harding. I serve as the Linus Pauling Chair at Oregon State University. And I'm here to leave you with a very positive signal about my ideas of the economic repercussions of a carbon cap and some of the different revenue models that have been discussed today. I've listed some of my experience, but most poignantly, I want to tell you specific examples of my career from being involved in technology and business development, and my ideas of how that is spurred by constraint and challenge. Let's start with something somewhat similar to the previous speaker. This is British Petroleum data for the last 20 years. And what I want you to take away from this isn't the growth. I think this is old news. But specifically, I want to show you that renewable energy is but a sliver in the worldwide energy usage. And this has got big ramifications for this conversation. If you look at either the growth rate or the magnitude, not even on the same order of magnitude. So the nuclear and hydro haven't and can't keep up with this pace for reasons that are likely clear to you. And so the conclusion I draw is that our thirst for energy is growing at a rate that far exceeds the growth of options. It far exceeds the growth of options, and that we have to take it upon ourselves, and I'm speaking to you also as a father of three daughters, to self-impose controls and do this in a way that really instigates economic development and conservation. Oregon is positioned to do this really well. I believe that from the bottom of my heart, from my experience in manufacturing, high tech, and now in academia as I prepare our engineers for the future world. But the takeaway that I want you to have from these first two slides is that renewables will not make up a significant contribution to this energy usage. And I'm hoping this graphic, no levels of investment, square footage assigned to solar panels or what have you, is going to do this. Now, I don't mean this pessimistically. You're talking to someone who's got 5.6 kilowatts on his shop and drove a Nissan Leaf up to Salem today. And I believe in conservation and being innovative, but I don't want anyone in this room to have the illusion that we can spend our way into making that sliver of renewable energies anything near to what we use. So I want to talk about some exciting opportunities for innovation and talk about what I call a case studies that I put together. But first I want to talk about Oregon specifically. My experience in working among Oregon engineers and scientists is that they are hungry for economic opportunities. And much like Mr. Golden's example of someone in a low end of socioeconomic level being innovative with their budget, you tell an engineer that they need to make a food dryer more efficient, watch out, because he or she is going to be so excited, inspired, you won't be able to cap their work hours. And Oregon, as you know, has an extremely high density of highly skilled, not just engineers and scientists, but workers in general. But we also have a consumer base that's passionate about the planet and is willing to make sacrifices, bike that extra mile, what have you. And so we're in a great situation to lead this country. So we are poised to lead business and technology innovation. I really believe that. But what's it take? So there's been some words used in previous testimony, and I'm going to try to put a thread together for you. And I'm going to park back on my experiences. First with HP, I was the technical lead for a fuel cell development program. And we looked at fuel cells for a variety of consumer products. I apologize if you can't see them. Everything from cell phones to laptops to replacements for the loud generators you hear in the campground, a fuel cell generator that would run off of propane. And we were responding to a customer need, which was battery life or fuel costs or sound in the case of our RV generator. But we investigated a number of different technologies. But what would the common theme that we always had was that we were looking at the competitive technologies and how predictable it was, how stable it was. And in the case of fuel cells, it was battery performance, for example. So we knew how well batteries performed, where the technology was going, and we could project that out, and appropriately, we made the right decision to cancel the fuel cell program. That was 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and if you look now, you don't see a lot of fuel cells out in the market, right? You don't see people popping methane cartridges into their laptops on airplanes, right? So we made the right decision. Battery technology was predictable, and we chose to step back. I want to talk about the business now of a close friend of mine who was started a company successfully to investigate cellulosic ethanol. And he was working with local agricultural lands to extract ethanol for fuel replacement, again, responding to a customer need of high dollars per gallon, dollars per mile, and to develop this ethanol manufacturing process for Willamette industry and in Oregon in general, agricultural product, and for example, grasses. And in the end, it was the unstable, undependable cost of the petroleum competition that drove them out of business. They went through cycles and eventually closed their doors. And I've included a picture of some of my friends are included in those people, all due to the instability of petroleum costs. So an example that I'm not directly involved in is Distributed Safe Nuclear, a company you've probably heard a lot about, NuScale. And what they're doing is developing a distributed and safe nuclear power scheme. It's gotten a lot of press and a lot of money. But similarly, they're responding to a signal, right, which is we need safer nuclear, and we've got high fossil fuel costs, and they're responding to that. They're developing processes that are safe and make nuclear power more distributable. But similarly, as you look at the variation in fossil fuel costs, that company, which includes a lot of my colleagues and peers, has gone through cycles of layoffs. These are fabulous engineers and scientists getting laid off, world-class engineers that are out on the street and then invited back 6 months later. And this comes at a tremendous loss in technology development efficiency. So My takeaway here is that innovators and engineers and scientists, investors, need long-term stability. And this we need on a multi-decade level, not 2 or 6 years or whatever the political cycle is. We need to know if we're going to invest our mortgage in something, if we're going to invest our money and our people, they need to know that this is something that's exciting moving forward. There's been another this concludes my presentation, a lot of comments. Senator Przanski's comment about sharing the pain being a very negative term. I am so inspired by these problems and opportunities that are going to be created by this scenario. I also want to comment, after hearing the last speakers, this dividend model, you know, politically, I think it really, really lowers the bar and makes it much more palatable because it seems so nonpartisan to me. And again, in the spirit of these last few slides, it seems like it creates so many business opportunities. Mr. Golden talked about the opportunity to provide energy-efficient methodologies for low-income households as an example. I mean, maybe someone wants to start a few companies up doing that. Very, very exciting. So with that, I'll conclude my comments, and I'm grateful for your time. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Hi, I'm Kristen Eberhard with Sightline Institute. Sightline is a Pacific Northwest think tank focused on energy, economic, and environmental policy. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what it would mean for Oregon to put a price on climate pollution. So a question that you might be wondering is Oregon going out on a limb by even thinking about this? And the answer is no. By next year, one quarter of all the greenhouse gas pollution in the world will have a price tag attached. So Oregon could join this movement, and there's a lot to learn from the programs that are already in place. So I'm going to draw particularly from the three North American programs. British Columbia's carbon tax, nine Northeast states, California and Quebec, have already been putting a price on pollution for years. So another question that's come up is, will this hurt the economy to put a price on pollution? And again, experience says no. British Columbia has been pricing pollution for years, and their economy has been keeping pace with the rest of Canada, where pollution is still free. California has been cutting pollution while actually growing its GDP. And the nine Northeast states have actually slightly outpaced the rest of the United States while they have been cutting pollution. And Portland State University's model showed that Oregon confirmed that this could be the same case in Oregon, that with a price on pollution, we could actually grow jobs. So another question is, shouldn't we just wait? There's the federal Clean Power Rule coming down. Maybe there's some national or international action down the line. And the answer to that is Oregons don't want to wait. As Julia said, there's a supermajority support for Oregon to stop pollution and transition to clean energy. But even beyond that, other states and provinces aren't waiting. And by taking action on pollution and clean energy, they're actually reaping benefits. So we've seen in California, it enacted its law in 2006, and it has attracted billions of dollars in private capital into clean tech ventures in the state. It's been growing its clean energy economy as a result of limiting pollution. And this is not surprising, because every dollar that we spend on clean energy solutions actually generates 2 to 3 times as many jobs as putting the same amount of money into fossil fuels. So if you think of that the other way, every year that Oregon does not price pollution and keeps buying out-of-state fossil fuels is another year that we lose the opportunity to create more local jobs in-state. And indeed, last year, 1 out of 78 jobs in the United States was a solar job. So Oregon could be one of these places in the world that is opening its doors to clean energy and welcoming in the money and the jobs that comes with that, or we could choose to keep that door shut and continue to give fossil fuels a free ride. So finally, there's a question about the Clean Power Rule, and that only affects electricity. And in Oregon, electricity is less than a quarter of our pollution. So both the bills in front of you today would price all four major sectors, which would get at 85% of the pollution in Oregon, which the Clean Power Rule is never going to do. But there is actually an opportunity with the Clean Power Rule. Either of these bills could be used as a compliance plan. So you could get a 2-for-1. You could actually comply with the federal rule while also keeping Oregon on the forefront of the clean energy economy. Okay, so let's say, right, we're ready to stop the free lunch for pollution. Let's put this cap on. What do we do with the money? So there's several things that we can do with the money, and California actually does a little bit of every one of them. So we can look at examples from California. The first thing that they do is help people and businesses by giving back some money to them. And the reason that this is so important is, as Dan talked about, this is for here in Oregon. The lowest income households spend a quarter of their income on energy-related costs. Now, it's important to note that's a percentage of their income. They're actually spending less money overall than the higher income, because people who make more money make so much more money that that 4% is actually a lot more money. But nonetheless, any increase in energy costs is going to hit those low-income households hard. But putting a price on carbon and then giving the dividends back to households would actually make two-thirds of Oregon households would have more money in their pocket at the end of the day with a price on carbon than they have right now without. So California gives that orange bar. They give most of that money is going back to households in a flat dividend or rebate on their electricity bill. And REGI also, the Northeast states also set aside some of the money to go back to households on their electricity bill. And finally, the British Columbia, they give all of the money back to households and businesses through tax cuts. So another thing that you heard from the opposition panel is that there are some businesses that are energy intensive and face competition from outside of the state, and they will need help with the transition to clean energy. So California spends a small amount of money, because it's actually not that many businesses that meet both of those criteria. Both energy is a big cost for them, and they're facing competition, so they might actually want to move. So carefully identifying those and then giving them money to help them make this transition is important. And finally, investing in clean energy solutions. So California spends that portion of their revenue, so it's about 40%, goes to clean energy, so mostly transit, energy efficiency, and electric cars and electric freight. The Northeast states spend most of their money on energy efficiency, which is a great investment because energy efficiency is actually the cheapest form of electricity that you can buy. And again, investing in energy efficiency creates jobs, and by definition, those jobs are local because you can't fix up the house from out of state. So finally, another thing to do is to spend the money on government general fund. And again, PSU's study found that putting it into schools and roads in the state will actually help grow jobs in every part of Oregon. So in closing, I want to address an idea that came up in the opposition panel that, you know, this is really about more pain and just pain indefinitely. This is not about more pain and making everything more expensive. This is about transitioning to clean energy. So right now we're dependent on this energy source that's unhealthy for us, for our children, for our planet, and it's really has a volatile price. So the idea here is to break those chains and actually become dependent on clean energy. So Oregon will be much better positioned if our homes and our businesses are as efficient as possible and our energy system is as clean as possible than we'll if we just try and stick with the status quo, because the status quo is not going to be the same. It is changing, and we cannot help that. What we can do is manage the change instead of letting it manage us. So in closing, the opposition said that they want a solution that's fair for all. Well, the constituents in this room and constituents who are at home, and including children who can't yet vote, they want a fair solution, and that means taking action now. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of the panelists?
Yeah, but it would take too long.
You can get really in one question before we leave. Yeah. One question.
Well, just, you know, I completely agree with where you're coming from, Kristen. I think that we need to take action now. One of the real challenges that we face here in Oregon that California does not is the restrictions that we have in our gas tax. And how do you see us getting beyond that? I mean, do you see us having to somehow change the Constitution? I had a bill this session, but anyway, to allow us to do that. I mean, can we really make progress given that, you know, how much of our use of carbon is tied to our transportation?
Yeah, so there's One possible route is changing the Constitution to free up that money. Another possible route is it is possible that a dividend could fit into the category of credits and rebates in the Constitution, and so you could use the money for the dividend. Another possibility is that the highway fund, even though it's for highways, but there is some flexibility within that. Some of that money goes to cities and counties, and they use that for local roads. And there's actually a lot of great and important things that cities could be doing to make their roads safer, to make them safer for low carbon forms of transportation like transit, biking, and walking. And so that money would not be wasted. It wouldn't be counterproductive in the way that building more highways will be very wasteful and counterproductive.
Thank you both for being here. Sorry we have to wrap it up, but we are due on the Senate floor 4 minutes ago. So thank you. Thank you for everybody that helped put the panels together. I appreciate it. And we are adjourned for the day.